Raidieraksts drošinātājs. Hello, Mark.
Hello, sir. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. A poodle named Danger, who comforts people on the front line, is certainly a great conversation starter. But before we talk about him, could you please tell me what Free the Ukraine is, the initiative you have started, and the one where your poodle Danger plays an essential role now?
Sure thing. So it all started when the war started, a little bit more than 3 years ago. I find myself in Ukraine working, basically representing Israeli medicine in the country of Ukraine, spearing a few medical projects. And then the war started. And instead of running back to Israel, we saw the situation on the ground, me and my partner, and we decided to stay because we understood we have an extensive resource, medical resource, which is very much needed in those moments. We didn't plan to start a movement or a foundation or an NGO. We come from business and we never did any major big scale volunteering or this kind of work. But we stayed and little by little it developed. We asked for some help from Israel and some doctors arrived to help. And then more doctors arrived. And then some doctors arrived from Ukraine. And little by little, Frida became this big mission of doctors volunteers from all over the world that volunteer on the front lines of the war in Ukraine. We open up field hospitals and we tend to the civilian population in those areas. And in those areas, it goes without saying that the medical resource is very scarce. There's almost none. The hospitals are not working or not staffed, and there's little chances for people who live there in the small villages of Donetsk, of Zaporozhye, of Kherson, of Kharkov, rarely get a chance to see a doctor. And even more rarely than that, they can see in one time 20 to 25 doctors of all professions, then see them in one sitting, in one day, and do the blood work, and do all the testing, and give the diagnosis, and give them free medicine, all in one day. Basically, it's a service of a moving hospital. That's what we do.
What areas are you operating in? Which areas?
Well, now I think there hardly is a region in Ukraine that we are not operating in.
Uh-huh.
First and foremost is the frontline regions, which are Donetsk, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Chernigov, Sumy, Kharkiv, and this is the front lines. Besides that, also operate in Nikolaev, in Dnepr. We operate in a less dangerous zones like Zakarpattia and Lvov region. There we tend to the misplaced families and the misplaced people and the children in the orphanages and the children's houses. So it's all over the Ukraine, basically.
And how many doctors are involved on a regular basis at the moment?
Well, the big number of doctors that are registered in Frida right now, if I'm not mistaken, is 1,572, give or take a few. It changes all the time. Those are basically doctors from all over the world that comes and joins our missions. And let's say around half of them, maybe a little bit more than half, are doctors from Ukraine, and the rest is doctors from all over the world, from Israel, United States, Europe, as far as Ecuador, that join our mission for a few weeks, for a month, and then they go back to their lives, and then they come again next year. We got quite big.
How does it work in real life? I mean, you see the need, let's say, in that village, then you call your doctors in your database and say, okay, could you come in 2 weeks for a week worth of work? Or how does it work in real life? I understand that there are no permanent doctors stationed in, like, near the front lines where, like, you could go every day. You said you are like a moving hospital that you bring all kind of doctors at one place at one time. How does it work in real life?
Well, first of all, I'll answer the last thing you said. It's not exactly true. We do have mobile hospitals, mobile units that are stationed in Sumy region and in Kharkov region. And they are there throughout the week. And the doctors working and manning those units are local and they are hired. They are not volunteers. They used to be volunteers, but in those specific cases, they are hired. and they work in those regions constantly. Now, to answer your question, how does it work? I can tell you how it began, and then I'll quickly explain how it is today. So it began with us helping the huge flood of refugees that fled the country in the first weeks of the war. And we treated them on the customs points between Ukraine and Poland, between Ukraine and Moldova, and then in the refugees camps. And then we came to Kyiv region, and we started going out to the deoccupied territories. Basically, if you remember, around 1 month into the war, the Ukrainians started to fight back and regain their territories. It started with Kyiv region, with towns like Borodyanka in Irpin and Bucha. That's usually the town everybody remembers. And then went on to Chernigov, then went on to Kherson, to Kharkov in the summer, and so on and so on. So we made it our mission to be the first boots on the ground, as they say, the first medical team on the ground, every deoccupied town. So Bucha got released. Next day, we were there with our volunteer doctors trying to get the situation underhand. We were dealing with people, mostly elderly, that stayed there, that were under 1 month, 1.5 months of occupation, without access to medical services, without pharmacies working, with nothing, basically. Not speaking about the horrors they went through, but the situation, the day-to-day situation medically was unbearable. And we came there with our freshly bought ambulances, packed with medications, with a few doctors, me in the cabin with the walkie-talkie and Danger, my poodle, sitting between my legs, my partner driving the ambulance, three doctors out back, and the rest of the space was full with medication. And we came and we gave out medication, gave out consultations. This is how it started. Today, it's already a big machine that if you ask me, where are your people right now? I cannot tell you. I need to coordinate and medical staff and ask them, because we have every week between 2 and 5 missions in different parts of the country. And how does it work? We are already very well known in the country, and we work with the administrations of all those regions. And they ask us, guys, can you come to this and this point? Can you come to this and this town? Sometimes we've been to and we are revisiting. Sometimes we come for the first time. And we put up a date. Let's say 2 weeks from now, we go into Avdiivka. We need 20 doctors. Those are the professions. We send it into the group. And people, the volunteers, fill up an application. To each mission, there's a captain, and he is tasked with manning the mission. The most amazing thing I can tell you, we spoke before we started this interview, about people being tired from this war and being tired to ask to help in the same issues. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you who is not tired, and it amazes me every day. The volunteers, the doctors are not tired. Every mission has a line of doctors that wants to get to the mission. And us, the management, the captains of the missions, have the hard task of choosing who will go and who will go next time. So this is something amazing that we're able to do, is to motivate those people, motivate those brave doctors to keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. This is their fight as well.
What do you believe is the primary motivation for them?
Oh, it's easy. The Ukrainian doctors, which are the heart of the project and the biggest part of every mission, they feel like they're soldiers on the ground. They feel like this is their participating in the war, because they work in the clinics, in the hospitals, in the day jobs, and then they come for a 2-3 day mission. And this is their contribution to the war effort. And it's a hell of a contribution. They're just, in my eyes, they're heroes. Not less so than the soldiers protecting the country.
As you said, there are more than 1,500 doctors at the moment enlisted in Frida's efforts. I'm not going to ask about, are there any Latvians, because you probably don't know, because there are so many doctors there. But if some doctor in Latvia hears that he or she doesn't have to go to Ukraine for half a year or a year, but he or she could go for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Is that an option? And should they contact you? And do you need them?
First of all, this is definitely an option. This is what we do. Do we need them? We need them very much, and I'll tell you why. This is a Ukrainian war, and quote-unquote Ukrainian problem. This is how some people view it.
Not in Latvia.
So thank you for that. Not in many places, but not by all people. The fact that doctors from other countries leave their families, leave their comfortable lives, leave their clinics, their patients, and they come and risk their lives in this mission, it means the world to the Ukrainian doctors to work shoulder to shoulder with doctors from Chicago Main Hospital or from Latvia or from any other place in the world. They feel like, first of all, there's a brotherly connection there, and they feel that they are part of the European medical sphere or the American medical sphere because they're working shoulder to shoulder with European doctors. They feel it's uplifting them. Also, what we try to do successfully with the European doctors that arrive and all the volunteers from abroad, we bring them. This is my mission. My mission is to have this time that I got granted from the Latvian doctor. I need to keep him busy. I cannot have him come for 3 weeks, do one mission, and get bored the rest of the time. He will not have the satisfaction that he contributed something. So we do whatever we can to fill out their day. Also, we take them to the hospitals, to the local hospitals, to the relevant departments of the hospitals that they know and that they are part of in their countries. We ask them to speak. We do small lectures in the universities, in the hospitals, and inside our organization to let them share their knowledge. It's called Frida Academy. It's something that also one of the directions of our organization. So they're not only helping on the ground, they help spread the knowledge and better the qualifications of the Ukrainian doctors. And it's very important. It motivates them like nothing else.
I have a question regarding security. You said, you know, as an example that, local municipality might call us and then we talk to our doctors that in 2 weeks we're going to go there at that specific time. And we know very well what Ukraine is fighting against. That's an enemy doesn't care for people's lives, and they don't target only the military installations and military personnel. They love to kill civilians as well. Regarding security, especially if it's a known information that a bunch of doctors is going to be at one place, at one time, near the front line, how is that working? How can you, of course, you cannot guarantee safety for anyone, but how do you keep your doctors safe?
That's a very good question. And it relates to a really real problem of logistics and security that we are facing every day. So first of all, if we are talking about the towns and the regions that are literally within reach of the front line, it never gets discussed. We never tell where we are going, and we never, in our social media or in the papers, we never let anybody know until every doctor left the region already. It goes without saying that we're in close touch with the military administration of each region, and we get constant feedback from them. And in some cases, when it's needed, we get security escort. If we are talking about missions in places like Bakhmut or Chasivyar, where there are intense fighting going on a few streets from where we do the intake, we get escorted in armored vehicles. The clinic, the triage is happening underground or in secure locations. So we do everything in our power to our people safe. To tell you the truth, I don't know how it is that in so many, many missions that we've done in those years, we did not get anybody hurt. We got shot at, I got shot at, my dog got shot at, when Russians were clearly shooting at volunteers and at doctors. More than one time and more than five times, my car got blown to pieces. in one of those shootings. There were incidents where our car carrying the doctors almost got into a minefield without knowing it's a minefield. There was so many cases. In one case, we arrived with all our doctors to a mission in Chasiv Yar, and literally the people that were waiting in the underground in one of the buildings waiting for the doctors, one of the patients waiting for us, he got up to smoke and he got shelled right there on the bench 30 seconds before our team arrived there, and he died in their arms basically. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you how it's logical that, thank God, none of our doctors were severely injured in any of those incidences. I think that God is with us and he likes what we're doing. I have no other explanations than that. But we have very strict security protocols. Also reminding the fact that we actually don't have borders. If you see other organizations like UNICEF, like Red Cross, like Doctors Without Borders, how funny it sounds, they do have borders. Some can go as close as 50 kilometers from the front line. Some can go as close as 30. None of them go to zero. We do not have those restrictions. We go after doing a very, very calculated security assessment. We go where we are needed. Sometimes it's one or two streets from the fighting.
And of course, it's all voluntarily, right? You tell your doctors, this is going to be the close one. This mission is going to be the close one to the front, and this is going to be further from the front, or they don't care. How is it?
We, of course, let everybody know all the details and the locations, and it's up to them. But they are, as iconic as it may sound, they are fearless. They want to go to where the danger is. They are, I don't know, either they really love the country or they're hooked on the adrenaline. That's the situation. They go everywhere they need it.
How else do you differ from other organizations that are involved in medical support of people in Ukraine, of civilians in Ukraine?
Well, I'll tell you how we are different, not only from medical organizations, but from, I think, 95% of all NGOs that do wonderful work, each in their respective direction, whether it's medical, humanitarian, financial, or otherwise. 95% of these kinds of organizations all over the world, not only in Ukraine, they do one thing. They collect money and they move this money around towards the beneficiaries of the help. That's what they do. Most organizations take money from donors, taxpayers, companies, and then they move it to another organization, then moves it to another organization, then buys something with it and then sends it. And it's a very long chain of events until eventually the beneficiaries of those help receive it after it went through 10 hands. What makes us special is we are the help. The hands of the doctors, their speciality, their talents, we actually provide the help with our own hands to the beneficiaries. We give them the medication, we examine them, we operate them. We are the only NGO in the country that has medical license. Basically, we can operate on the go like a hospital. It's an amazing thing because we touch them. We come as close as it can be to those people that we help.
I want to talk now about the Little Hearts project. That's one of the projects of Free the Ukraine. Free the Ukraine systematically supports, as I understand, the relocated children's institutions through the Little Hearts project. Why was it so important to create a separate dedicated project for children's homes?
Thank you for this question. Not many understand it from the get-go. So basically, it started as one more mission. Like, we go to this or that region, and somebody told us that there's an orphanage there and that it has no doctor because the doctor left the country, and we went to this orphanage. And then we went to another orphanage and we treated it as a regular mission. And then we say, stop. This is not really, it's not the right thing to do because we cannot treat children, many of them, or they are the product of an abused family or parents, or they are misplaced from very dangerous regions that got shelled and hit by the war. So we cannot treat those children as though they're adults who are responsible for their future. If we come to Kherson and we treat the people there, we leave them with medication and instruction and an understanding of the problem. We cannot do this with children. It's a totally different patient. So then we created the Little Huts program. And what we did is, in the beginning, we took around 10 facilities throughout Ukraine, and we became their medical caretakers, basically, throughout the year. So we come to those facilities twice a year with a multidisciplinary team of doctors, and we go through all the children, check up everything, do the examinations, give the instructions to the staff, give the medications needed. We take them out of the facility to hospitals that we work with to make different small operations or corrections, what we see fit. We handle them also psychologically. Many of those kids are severely traumatized, and we work with them with our psychology department throughout the year. And we take care of the humanitarian needs of the facility. We fix their playgrounds. We fix their kitchens. We buy them clothes. So we became like the caretakers of this facility. This is the program, basically. This is what's different about it. We are responsible from A to Z of what's happening medically with those children all year round.
But I understand that, or have I misunderstood, that you also take those children away from those, from east of Ukraine, and bring them to west of Ukraine, relocate them?
It's not something that we do, no.
Oh, okay.
It's something that we work with facilities that have relocated children in them.
Okay.
We don't have the authority to do it because it's a governmental system in Ukraine.
If you have worked in children's homes in Ukraine, can we call those kids whose situation understandably is very grave, even without the war, but now with the war, it's even worse. But knowing that Russia has stolen many kids also from children's homes, from occupied territories.
That's right.
That those kids that have stayed in Ukraine-controlled territories in children's homes, they are better off than other kids there from occupied territories that have been stolen.
It's a hard question. It's a very hard question.
And I don't know if I have formulated it good enough, but I think you got my idea about, we are hearing that so many children have been stolen from Ukraine to Russia, and we don't know the destiny of many of them at all.
Yes, I can tell you from my own personal experience, in the first year of the war, we were coming back all the time to Donetsk, to a few cities close to the front line, especially Bakhmut. It was even before that Bakhmut became this very important point known throughout the world. It was just another town for us. And we worked there it was constantly shelled. And there were children and families, but we're talking about the children now, children living underground in safe houses, underground, for as long as 8 or 9 months up in that point. That was all their life, basically. We have documented this process. They had beds, and all their life, everything they possess, all the pictures, all the toys, are around that bed. And it's just a maze of underground. I don't know what the space used to do. Was it the parking ground or just warehouses? But this is where they lived, and we were with them for a few months. And then, if you remember, everybody tried to evacuate them, but they wouldn't be evacuated because of their families. And in one point, the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he gave an order to take them by force, get all the children out of there, because it was understood that we're going to lose the city. That's what happened. They just disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to them. Some, we know, after many investigations, went to the other side. Some were not kidnapped, but taken by their families because they didn't want to leave and they didn't want the children to get evacuated by volunteers. So this is tearing my heart because I know the kids. I literally spend for a few months, our organization went there off, on and off, and spent a lot of time with those children, and they disappeared. And nobody knows what happened to them. And we hear horror stories about some kids that were taken and then re-educated, in quotes, by the Russian Federation. It's very hard to do comparison because we literally don't know the day-to-day lives of those children. Maybe some of them got to foster homes or families and they're better off. Who can tell? I don't know. But what's 100% certain, they are not home. They are not in the environment that they used to know and used to call home. And the minimum, the silver lining for the kids that we tend to in the orphanages and children's home in Ukraine today, they're home and they're loved by members of the family who are still alive, and they're loved by their teachers and caretakers, and they're loved by our volunteers. And we do everything we can for them.
Let's talk about you before we talk about your dog. What is your background? I mean, what you said, you work in medical field, Israel, and you were working also in Ukraine. But other than that, what is your background and why you feel sympathy for Ukraine, and why did you stay and organize the freedom?
Basically, I started my way in the restaurant business and the event planning business in Israel, also retail, fashion stores. Then I came to what's called in the industry medical tourism. Basically, I had a lot of wealthy clients all around the world that we brought to Israel, to our hospital, which we are representing. We are the international department of this hospital. Hospital called Ichilov. This is the biggest hospital in central Israel. It's like a mountain of medicine. And we bring patients from all over the world to go to treatments in the hospital. This is how it started. Then COVID came, as you may remember. And then no more tourism. If there's no more tourism, there's no more medical tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat down and tried to decide what to do. By the way, there's no more restaurants, no more events. So everything that I do was hit pretty hard. So I came to Ukraine because I have a lot of good connections there and good friends working there. And me and my partner, Roman, we started working on private medical facilities, building a few projects, doing a lot of work with ventilators and buying and selling equipment and everything that we can do to bring opportunities that was closed by COVID. Because Ukraine wasn't quick to react, and many steps that were taken in other countries came late to Ukraine, and we tried with our resources to compensate on that. And that's what we were doing when the war started, basically. We were in the middle of three major projects, medical projects in Kyiv, that we invested in, that we worked for almost 2 years on, and then the war. And all the investment is, you can see it just being taken over with, along with the rest of Ukraine, by the Russian Federation. And you stand and you look at this avalanche coming towards you, and you understand that everything you worked for the last 2 years is probably gone, and you have nothing that you can do about it. And then you are left with the decision, put your tails between your legs, no offense, danger, and go back to Israel, or you stay there and you try to help any way you can. And that's what we did.
Many people feel sympathy for Ukraine, but not everyone is ready to take action. What was the reason you helped more than a week or a month? Or
first of all, it's an addictive process. I think what changed for me completely is the first mission. It wasn't called a mission, it's just something that we did. We received, after a few weeks from the beginning of the war, we received our first ambulance from our donors, friends that were aware of the situation and the fact that we are there trying to help. So they send us an ambulance from Spain filled with medications, till the roof. And we didn't know what to do, but we knew that in the same day, one of the towns in Kyiv region was liberated the same day. So I did a post on Facebook with myself and my partner and the main rabbi of Ukraine that was also a big help for us in the beginning. And we just, in Facebook, we called all our friends and we said, this is the ambulance. We're going tomorrow to see what's going on there. We need a few doctors with us. And three doctors said, yes, let's go. And we went. And what happened there, it was a Friday, Shabbat for us. What happened then, what we saw there, it changed my life completely. We were under the impression we're going to arrive with doctors. We understand medicine. We have all this experience and we have a medication and we will come and we will treat people. And as soon as we arrived to the center of the town, we were in a few seconds surrounded by around a few hundred people. This is winter in Ukraine after a month of occupation. Just surrounded by hungry people that were left without medicine, with chronic diseases, and they're just begging for us, give us medication. And we found ourselves giving out bread because some guy parked his car next to the ambulance and started selling bread. So we bought all the bread and started giving it away for people. So me and my partner giving away bread, doctors in the ambulance giving away medicine. And this is just, nothing prepares you to it. Just nothing prepares you to seeing that. And then another one and another one. And you understand that there's, that everything you think you knew, you put it aside and you're doing this now. You're in the center of the most horrific war of the century, and you can help. You see what you can do for people, for human beings that speak the same language I do. I cannot speak for anybody else, but it's a matter of, if you see somebody fall on the street, whether you walk on by or just pass him and go about your day, or you try to help him get up. That's it. It's just between you and yourself and your God and your conscience.
You mentioned you and your partner, but I understand that there is another partner of yours, apparently a scary animal called Danger.
Very scary.
As this is a radio show, and the interview is also going to be in a written format, so we cannot see it with our own eyes. Could you describe your dog for us?
Well, we need to stay with the facts here. He is a poodle. He is a toy poodle. But don't let this just break the idea that he is dangerous, because you need to hear his roar.
Right.
And you need to get to know his personality. This is a special, special dog. He has a certain personality, human-like qualities. I'm not kidding. It's not because he's my dog. He's been with me for 8 years, so I can be objective already. I understand what he has that other dogs don't have. And he, before the war and before Ukraine, he had a certain likability to him. First of all, he's a free spirit. He never wears a collar, or I take him by a leash. Never. He's absolutely independent, walks where he likes. He's a good dog. He listens. He knows his place. And he has a certain way with people and with dogs. He automatically gets his way, gets his access to people and to dogs who are, I remember I had a few stores in Tel Aviv, and I was, during the day, I was visiting the stores to see how the business is going. And he was coming with me. And Tel Aviv is a city with a lot of dogs. Everybody has dogs in Tel Aviv. And he was sitting next to this store and that store and greeting the people walking with the dogs. And after a while, he had, I think, three, maybe four, it was quite a while ago, abused dogs. The owners took them from an abused situation or from shelters, and the dogs weren't socialized. They were scared of other dogs and they were scared of people. They weren't playing with anybody, but they played with Danger. And the owners were shocked that they actually play with another dog. So they used to ask me, what time are you going to be there? I want to bring my dog so he can have a connection with somebody. And that's years ago, yeah. And he has this connection with people as well.
So why the hell did you call him Danger if he's not dangerous?
It's this original side to me that I want to be not like everybody else. And I want my dog to name not like everybody else. And I remember relentlessly trying to find a cool, funny, original name for him that will also fit, you know? You cannot call your dog a refrigerator. It's original, but it has no... But this just stuck. And I really love the fact that his name is Danger. This literally, in the first moment, when you see a dog on the street and you want to pet him, you ask the owner, what's his name? And I've been asked that time and time again. And I answer, Danger. So it's instantly puts a smile on somebody's face. You understand? It's a conversation starter.
Well, and if you said he's been with you for 8 years, so should I conclude that he has been with you in Ukraine also from day one and has gone to the missions?
That's correct. From the first mission, he was with me in the ambulance. In the beginning, because the missions were not planned, it was it was quite rough. So he didn't have a role. Yeah, he was there and he stepped out of the car. If there was a more comfortable situation with tables or people actually, doctors actually not only giving out medications from the window, but actually seeing patients. So he was there walking between the patients waiting to see the doctor. Now you need to understand, those situation has a lot of pressure and a lot of fear in the eyes of those people. They haven't seen a doctor since the beginning of the war. Some cases they haven't seen a doctor for many years before because they live in some remote village. And they come together, a few dozens, a few hundreds sometimes, and they wait. And there's a lot of tension in this waiting area. And then danger walks in. And immediately a smile is put on everyone's faces. And they weren't smiling before, but because there's nothing to smile about in this kind of situation. When you see doctors in vests and helmets going with papers and trying to get to everybody, it's not a lovely situation. But he gets there and he breaks the tension. And elderly people go to the ground to play with him. And children are uplifted by him. And it has a therapeutic side to it. And it's very important when you come to a doctor to be not on the edge and not agitated and not scared. So it's something so simple. In a million years, I wouldn't have thought about it. But I just saw it happen. Every time he was there, there was something, there was hope, something uplifting. And when children are there, it's a whole different story with danger than without them.
Could you share a specific vivid anecdote where danger's interaction directly facilitated a medical examination or an emotional breakthrough with a child? Perhaps something that truly surprised even your experienced medical team?
Well, in general, where we see the effects really, really in a strong way, many of the facilities that we care for in the Little Hearts Project are facilities with kids who are not 100% healthy. We're talking about kids with serious physical disabilities or children on the spectrum. They do not connect as good to the outside world and to our doctors, which makes it very hard to treat them. Of course, our doctors are professionals and pediatricians who have all the necessary skills, but it takes time to get through to those little patients.
Sure.
And with danger, because first of all, you need to understand the picture. All our doctors are wearing uniform. They're wearing, when it's winter, they're wearing hoodies. When they're summer, they're wearing t-shirts with all the logos and all the, they're all blue. And then danger is there also with a hoodie or a t-shirt, and it's the same color and it says Frida on it, and he's part of the team. So there is an immediate connection there. You understand that the dog is, it's not just a stray dog or somebody's dog. He's there to do something. He has a mission on his with his time. And the children just, it molds in together everything, the children and the dog and the doctors. They're holding him in their hands and the doctors can work with them because they're busy and because they are more involved with the process. This is big scale. It's not a one story. It's just a big scale. It works like a magic.
And I mean, he's a small-time celebrity. I see in front of me, I have opened his Instagram account. He has his own Instagram account with almost 1,000 followers.
I don't think it's a lot, but it's something we try now to, basically we try to tend to that and to put more stuff of him out there. I wish I've done it from the beginning, but I didn't. So better late than never. The local press loves him. So there's lots of stories coming out with him every other week now. So yeah, he's a little bit of a celebrity. I think he knows it too. Attitude is changing, changing a little bit. Yeah. He loves the attention.
Okay. But we talk about, you know, emotional toll on civilians, on soldiers, on volunteers from the war. But what impacts does the frontline leaves on a dog if we talk about the danger? Have you noticed anything or he just doesn't care?
You know, people ask me that all the time. More than that, they even in some cases, they critic the fact that we take him with us or I take him with me. Because why? It's a poor little dog. He doesn't understand. I really try to explain it to myself because I ask myself this question because I know other dogs, they get scared when there's hard noises loud noises, that they're scared where there's a lot of people, they get scared when strangers touch them. And he's not like that at all. So I think it's a combination of him being around a lot of people and noisy places in the beginning of his life, restaurants and crowded places and big concerts and events and get-togethers, and the fact that he gets his cue from me. If I'm relaxed, he's relaxed. You can make all the noise that you can. He looks at me, at my eyes, and if he sees that everything is okay and I'm calm, he's going to be calm as well. But if the situation is not that dangerous, but he sees that something is going on with me, that there is something that I react to, he will react to it as well, and he will be worried, and he will not be as playful as he usually is.
So basically, he is keeping you in line, because you know that if you're going to be too emotional or too, you know, scared or something, he will also be like that. So you probably must keep your emotions in check as well.
Well, I think that's what we do with loved ones and kids and friends and spouses, right? We try to make it easier for them. So we keep some things on the inside. This is the kind of relationships we have.
Is he right next to you?
Yeah, he's right sitting looking at me right now. We're on the beach.
Is there a chance maybe you know how to let him speak or so we can hear him?
Let him speak. No, he's actually a very quiet boy. Danger. He won't make like a sound unless I tell him, go get it, you know, to get something like birds or whatever. Otherwise, he's a quiet dog.
All right. And finally, I have to ask you about you coming from Israel and volunteering in Ukraine at the time when Israel also has been under attack and is not living through its, very harmonious period. You hear many activists around the world putting Ukraine and Israel in the same sentence, but in very different meanings. And those meanings could wildly differ depending on what kind of activists those are and stuff like that. But I've heard quite many also delusional comparisons and stuff like that. But how does it make you feel as an Israeli living in Israel, volunteering in Ukraine, and both of those places being involved in the war? Do you see any similarities? Do you see any connections? How does it make you feel?
Well, of course, I see the similarities and the connections. This is one of the things from the beginning of the war in Ukraine that got me, I think, on a personal level, on an emotional level, so involved, and so it became my fight a little bit. Because I know my history, I know the history of my people, I know the history of Israel, the wars it has, it's been through. So when the war in Ukraine started, and at that time there was nothing out of the ordinary going on in Israel, it was a very easy comparison. And I remember myself telling the people I meet in Ukraine, listen, guys, we've been through that and it's hard and you are going to have very rough times and this war is going to end someday, but it's going to continue in one way or another, because I don't know if I can use those words on radio, but your neighbors are going to keep being assholes like our neighbors are assholes. So it's never the end. There are times of peace and times of a little less peace. This is the situation. This is the world we live in. But, and that's what I told my Ukrainian friends, but your country will start flourishing. Your industries will start getting better. The West is going to invest more. It already has, and it's going to invest more, and it's going to rebuild, and your military capabilities will be strong, and people will, that will result in growth, and real estate is going to grow. And there is, I see that the example of Israel and how it went out of being a poor country to one of the best financial wise in the region and in the world. It has something to do with one another, the situation that we are surrounded by enemies and in constant state of being prepared for war. So this was in the beginning. the comparison was a good comparison, understandable. But then the war in Israel started, this war in Israel. And from day one and until today, we're winning the war, but we are losing the war of the information war. We are losing it. We are being hated around the world. Again, I don't want to go into full political scale here because I have a lot to say and I say it often and I try to explain the situation as best I can in Ukrainian media and around the world. It's important to me. It's important that my people are, their story is being discussed in the right way, in the way of facts and not of empty slogans. So today, the situation got a little bit different. I still see it the same way. We are small. We are a small country surrounded by big enemies who wants to destroy us. Ukraine, comparing to Russia, is a small country with a small GDP. Being terrorized. I see the similarities. But now, and this is the absurdity of what the media and the situation got to, and the fake news, is we are being compared to the Russian occupiers and to the Russian aggressors. And this hurts me. I cannot even explain to you how much. This misconception. Understand that it's easy to blame like this. It's easy. You need to really understand what's going on to put all the chips in the right place, to understand the situation of Israel, the response that we have to do. It's not simple. And people, they have no time or patience for complicated explanations. They want simple explanations. Good, bad, black, white, strong, weak. They don't need to dig any further. That's the world we live in. I don't know if I answered your question, but this is how I feel about it.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for the work you're doing in Ukraine, and best of luck for you and the great dog, Danger. And hopefully, maybe some Latvian doctors will hear this interview, and maybe we'll join Frida for some time.
We'll be honored to have your good doctors with us.
Yeah, there are some actually.
And I can assure you, they'll have wonderful stories to tell on your show.
Good. Anyways, let's hope for a Ukrainian victory and be safe. Be safe, you, your doctors, and of course, Danger.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the light that you shed on the subject and on this war. And keep on the good work. Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава. Radio Raksts drošinātājs.
Paldies tev, Dīvu, par sarunu ar Marku Nevjažski, ar Ukrainā lielākās brīvprātīgo mediķu misijas Frida izveidotāju. Nu, zini, lieliski ideja man šķiet tomēr tā, ka šis pūdels tur ir klātesošs. Nu, pirmkārt, ja mēs padomājam karš pats par sevi, kādas ir cilvēka emocijas, kā cilvēki jūtās šādos apstākļos, un vēl bez tā arī nu, ikdienā arī. Mēs, kad dodamies pie ārsta, nu, tas noskaņojums jau nu, pārsvarā droši vien ejot uz šādām vietām, nu, nav jau tas pats priecīgākais. Un pūdeles man šķiet ir lielisks veids, kā uzmundrināt cilvēkus. Es arī nebūtu pret, ja dodoties tepat Latvijā, Rīgā pie ārsta, mani sagaidītu arī kāds dzīvnieciņš. Nu, visticamāk arī varbūt kāds mīlīgs un pūkains. Ir jau daudz dzīvnieku, varbūt kādam ārstam labāk patiktu turēt kastītē zirnekli un tā iepriecināt savus klientus, bet nu, tas gan nebūtu mans stāsts.
Nu jau tu aizpildēji. Klausies, es, protams, negribētu šo interviju noreducēt tikai uz pūdeli. Skaidrs, ka pūdels vārdā briesmas ir vienkārši dabisks āķis, uz kuru uzķēros es, kad pamanīju šo informāciju, un mēs to nelietīgi izmantojam arī mūsu pašu epizodes nosaukumā, lai piesaistītu uzmanību, bet atkal jau caur šo stāstu mēs varam izstāstīt vēl lielāku stāstu, proti par šiem te brīvprātīgiem ārstiem, un tas, ko mūsu sarunā Marks pieminēja, bet intervijā tas neiekļuva, bija fakts, ka viņiem bez šīm te izbraukuma sesijām, teiksim tā, ir arī mobīlai hospitāļi Sumu un Harkivas reģionā, kuri tur darbojas katru darba dienu. Tātad nav tikai izbraukums, bet ir arī tad pastāvīgi. Viņi tur, jā, var braukāt šurp tur, bet viņi vienmēr tur ir. Tajos strādā nu jau algoti vietējie ārsti, kur iepriekš darbojās kā brīvprātīgie. Bet vēlreiz gribēšu uzsvērt to informāciju, kas būtu arī aktuāla Latvijas speciālistiem, medicīnas speciālistiem. Tātad, redz, jūs tur gaida kaut vai tikai uz divām nedēļām. Varbūt tiešām ir vērts doties, tā ir iespēja gūt pārliecību, ka aizbrauksiet, nevis sazina kur un darīsiet nezin ko, bet jums jau būs sagatavots pilns, kārtīgs, pilnvērtīgs plāns visam jūsu uzturēšanās laikam. Paši dzirdējat, jūs klātbūtni būtu ļoti svarīgi no visdažādākajiem aspektiem. Tā skaitā uzmundrinot savus kolēģus Ukrainā, tā skaitā daloties ar savu pieredzi un noteikti nevienam vien speciālistam šī būtu neatsverama iespēja uzzināt, iegūt pieredzi no ukraiņu kolēģiem. Ja jūs interesē šāda iespēja, protams, par drošību vienmēr ir jādomā, un tas ir katra individuālais lēmums, te varam vispār nav vietas, protams, tas ir pašam katram jāizsver individuāli. Bet ja jūs ieinteresē šāda iespēja, tad uzmeklējiet sociālajos mēdījos Frīda Ukraine, rakstās tā kā izrunāja Frīda Ukraine, vai arī galā varat rakstīt mums, vai ietekojiet man vai Rihardu sociālajos mēdījos, mēs noteikti jums palīdzēsim saiet kopā ar Marku Nevjažski un viņa vadīto brīvprātīgo mediķu misiju Frīda Ukraine. Tas šajā sezonā mums pat būtu it kā viss. Ieskatīsimies vēl pastikastītē. Un tā kā mums šī ir pēdējā epizode, tad tas ir parasti. Šādas sarunas un pārdomas ir pēc katras sezonas. Nu, kā tad mēs strādāsim tālāk? Skaidrs ir, ka mēs atgriezīsimies 4. septembrī. Ja jums ir savas idejas, ko mums vajadzētu darīt citādāk, labāk vai kā atšķirīgi, tad uzrakstiet mums. Nesol, ka visu izdarīsim, kā vēlaties, bet noteikti ieklausīsimies un, kā zin mūsu pastāvīgie klausītāji, nevien vien intervija šeit ir izskanējusi pēc jūsu klausītāju ieteikumiem.
Jā, varbūt ir kāds temats pa vasaru, kas ienāk prātā, ko jūs vēlētos, lai mēs par to sīkāk parunājam un pastāstām, vai, protams, arī kādi jūs tikko minēji, kādas interviju idejas, kādi interesanti cilvēki, kas jūs prāt būtu jādzird arī citiem, ko mēs varētu nointervēt un ar kuriem parunāties. Tāpēc, jā, mūsu e-pasts aizvien ir nemainīgs, drošinātājs @latvijasradio.lv, pārbaudām to vienmēr un gaidīsim arī ziņas no jums. Un, nu, ko jāsaka, paldies, ka klausījāties un bijāt uzticīgi mums arī šajā sezonā. Paldies arī tev divu, ka izturēji mani šajā laikā. Cerams, ka sadarbosimies arī turpmāk, vai ne?
Ja ukraiņi var izturēt, es nevaru, man nav iemesli sūdzēties. Viss kārtībā. Paldies tev. Paldies visiem kolēģiem, paldies Kristīnai Bērziņai, paldies arī mūsu fantastiskajai aizkadra kolēģei Norai Micpapai, kur saliek viss kopā tā, ka mēs izklausamies tā, it kā nekad dzīvē nepārteiktos. Tā nav. Jā, paldies visiem kolēģiem un, protams, vislielākais paldies visiem, kas mūs klausās, kas noklausījušies līdz pašām beigām. Atsūtiet mums kādu vēstulīti, lai zinām, ka ir tur vēl beigās kāds klausītājs. Tā kā paldies par šo sezonu, trešā sezona ir beigusies. Diemžēl, šobrīd izskatās tā, ka ja nekas nepiedzīvo dramatiski lielas izmaiņas, tad mēs tiekamies arī drošinātāji 4. Sezonā, kas sāksies 4. septembrī. Paldies un tad arī uz salīdzinoši drīzu sadzirdēšanos. Visu labu!
Visu labu! Drošinātājs skaidri un personīgi par karu Ukrainā.
Raidieraksts drošinātājs.